Are science and religion friends? Sexual promiscuity among the grandparent generation. College and marriage plans. Free speech in Holland. And a breakdown of the American electorate. It's Tuesday, October 12, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. One thing's for certain, Jerry Coyne pulls no punches. Professor of Ecology and Evolution at the University of Chicago, Jerry Coyne is an ardent opponent of religious belief. He sides with the New Atheists. In an article published in Monday's edition of USA Today, he cites the New Atheists and their argument that there is an irreconcilable chasm between Christianity in particular and evolution, between, as he calls it, religion and science. Now, when you look at the argument of Jerry Coyne in USA Today, you see an argument that is a summary. It's a short article, but it certainly gets to the point. After identifying the New Atheists, he comes back to say, every time the New Atheists write a book, someone comes back to say they're exaggerating. They come back to say there really isn't any warfare between science and religion. There really isn't any problem here. He sides with the New Atheists. He says, of course there is. He says that religious belief and evolution, or Christianity and science, are, in the end, irreconcilable. Now, in my article entitled Science and Religion Aren't Friends, that's a question mark based off of his article by the title Science and Religion Aren't Friends at USA Today, I come back to suggest that Christians have come up with basically three different positions when it comes to the engagement between Christianity and evolution. The first position is basically an abdication. It's a pure accommodation to evolutionary theory. It's the assumption of basically naturalistic terms as the foundation of a Christian worldview. Of course, that's disaster. That means you have to rewrite the entire faith. That means you have to start from Genesis to Revelation and completely revisit Scripture. And what you're basically doing there is just making Scripture bow its knee to the current prevailing model of evolutionary science. At the other end of the spectrum, there are those who suggest that there is no way to reconcile Christianity and evolution. The only way the Christian gospel and our affirmation of Scripture can remain true and have integrity is if we understand that the naturalistic biases of evolution make it absolutely impossible to make peace. Now, there are those who from the very beginning have tried to carve out some kind of middle position. They come back and say, a pox on both your houses. There can be a peace. There can be a way for Christianity to remain Christian and come to terms with evolution, and for evolution to remain evolution as a theory and to make peace with religion, and that's in general, or Christianity specifically. Now, what we're talking about here is the possibility of theistic evolution. And if you've been listening to me for any length of time at all, you know that I reject theistic evolution. Just as a linguistic compound, it ought to be absolutely false. There is no way to make evolution theistic, nor to make theism come to terms with the modern naturalistic assumptions of evolution. But there are those who try. Jerry Coyne isn't one of them. As a matter of fact, he sees such efforts as being rather pathetic. This is a very interesting juxtaposition. We have those who, on the evolutionary side, say, oh, yes, you can make peace. You can be a theistic evolutionist. And those who say you cannot. But the two groups who agree in this are the ardent atheists and the evangelical Christians, those who hold to biblical Christianity and to the total truthfulness of the Scripture concerning all things, including the origin of the world. Now, we're in a very interesting position here. Jerry Coyne writes that those who argue that science and religion are completely compatible friends, well, he rejects it. I'm going to quote him here from his article in Monday's USA Today. He says, as a scientist and former believer, I see this as bunk. Science and faith are fundamentally incompatible, and for precisely the same reason that irrationality and rationality are incompatible. They are different forms of inquiry with only one science equipped to find real truth, and while they may have a dialogue, it's not a constructive one. Science helps religion only by disproving its claims, while religion has nothing to add to science, end quote. Now, rarely do you see a paragraph of that kind of candor. Rarely do you see it in the mainstream media because what you basically have in the mainstream media is a public relations effort to popularize evolution. You don't popularize evolutionary theory by putting this kind of argument in the face of those who reject it. And how many Americans reject evolution? Well, polls indicate that it's over 75%. That's what's driving evolutionary scientists like Jerry Coyne crazy. They're being driven to derision by the fact that the vast majority of Americans just aren't buying into the theory of evolution, and instead they hold to something like a biblical doctrine of creation, whether they understand it in any detail or not. They have at least the intellectual instinct to reject evolution. But what you have in Jerry Coyne's article is pure scientism. And I want you to see its definition here. Number one, it's purely naturalistic. That is to say, it accepts only natural explanations. It sees the cosmos as a giant box, and the box is made up of purely natural forces and natural material things, and they have to be self-explanatory. There can be no explanation from outside the box. There is no supernaturalism. And in their view, you're absolutely mentally incompetent. You are irrational. That's the word that he uses here. If you try to bring supernaturalism into your worldview. The next thing you see is that it's absolutely materialistic. It deals only with the stuff. Jerry Coyne's writings, including his book, Why Evolution is True, are purely materialistic. There is stuff. There's stuff of atom and molecules and all the rest, and there is no kind of other stuff. For instance, he is a pure physicalist when it comes to the human being, rejecting the notion of a supernatural soul. Now, that is, of a created soul, of a spirit. No, that has to go. Instead, physicalism suggests that what we have is merely a brain that operates on the basis of chemical compounds and interactions and all the rest, purely physical explanation. Now, it's really interesting to look at this argument in USA Today because Jerry Coyne makes it in an undiluted form. Again, he takes no prisoners. He pulls no punches. He goes right at it. He doesn't believe that there are many religious scientists. He cites the sociologist Elaine Howard Eklund as suggesting that fully 64% of American scientists are atheists or agnostics, and he says that's basically the way it is. That's the way it more or less should be, or maybe he would rather it be 100%. Here's what's really interesting. He goes at folks like Francis Collins, who try to be theistic evolutionists, and he suggests there's absolutely no credibility to their position. Now, coming from the exact opposite position of worldview, I'm in agreement with him on that judgment. But we need to note exactly what's going on here. This is, number one, a form of intellectual intimidation. That's what he's trying to do. He's trying to intimidate persons from holding to any kind of theistic belief and to render it just intellectually disrespectful. Disrespectable, for that matter. Then you also see that what he goes at here is the removal of any kind of middle ground. The middle ground that he sees requiring too much compromise from the theory of evolution. I come at it from the other position and say, no, what it requires is too much compromise from biblical Christianity. There's simply no retreat. It is one or the other. Now, in terms of modern science, what Jerry Coyne represents is naturalistic science. As a Christian, I have to come back and say that's not the only kind of science there is. Science doesn't have to be done on a naturalistic worldview. Christians have known from the very beginning that there is a true science that is done on the basis of all of the data, including the supernatural data. But that's another story, and that's not what Jerry Coyne was addressing. What we have in his article is naturalism full bore. The New York Times and Time Magazine are out with a very interesting study. And the study that they report on was done by the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University. Indiana University is famous, no, it should be infamous, for the Kinsey Center there for the study of human sexuality. But this study is very interesting for what it reveals generationally. I like the way Time Magazine does it. Their headline is, "Between the Sheets, a new sex study indicates unmarried baby boomers behave more recklessly than teens." That's right. Belinda Luscombe reports off of this study, and it's replicated in other articles as well, that what we have in our current sexual moment as a society is a moment in which baby boomers are still acting just like the baby boomers they have been. They're acting like a lawless generation, and here's the surprise. They are actually more sexually promiscuous. They are more sexually immoral than adolescents. And this may be the first time, in terms of this kind of very large sex study, that this kind of data has been absolutely documented. I'm not going to read to you from this study because it's a bit more graphic than I intend to detail, but you can find it online, and you can find the report in Time Magazine and in the weekend edition, Sunday edition of the New York Times. Robin Karen Rabin, their reporting for the New York Times, suggests that what we have in this particular picture are grown-ups. They're grandparents now who have friends with benefits just like teenagers were parodied as having just a matter of, well, just a few years ago. I won't go into the detail, but I'll tell you the detail is present, and what the detail tells us is the story that we learn all the way back in Genesis 3. When it comes to marriage, there is a big statistical reversal that ought to have our attention, and this is coming from census data in particular. The Pew Research Center is reporting that for the first time in American history since such questions were asked, it is now the case that college graduates are more likely to be married than non-college graduates. If you go back to the early decades of the 20th century, when college became the experience of many young Americans, it delayed marriage, and for some of them, it relativized marriage. Throughout the 20th century, those who did not have a college education were actually more likely to be married than those who did. But that's now transformed. It has switched. It is switched by a small percentage right now. As of this report, 62% of college-educated 30-year-olds were married or had been married, compared with 60% of those without a bachelor's degree. Now, one of the other data points in the study is that the median age at first marriage for those lacking degrees has risen to 28, and is 27 for the college-educated. Now, one of the things we look at in this particular study is the effect of higher education. The effect of higher education generally has been to liberalize the worldview. The effect across a generation of higher education has been to delay the onset of adulthood. But what we're finding here is not so much that college-age young people are growing up faster. In fact, the data tells us that's not true. What we have instead are non-college-educated folks who just aren't growing up. They're not growing into adulthood. What's missing? Well, clearly, the breakdown of the family is something to do here, the breakdown of social expectations. This particular study and the media reporting on it point to economic factors, the difficulty of a couple or an individual making enough money to be able to be married. But, you know, that just doesn't wash with me, because previous generations had less, far less, went through economic turmoil far greater, went through the Great Depression, still found a way to get married, stay married, have kids, and raise a family. This tells us more about a worldview shift than an economic shift. It also tells us something about a social crisis in our midst of people who see marriage as something that is no longer for them. It's a lifestyle option that is no longer the one they choose. Cohabitation becoming normalized leads virtually inevitably to this kind of profound social shift. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, a very brave woman who was once a member of the parliament in the Netherlands, is reporting in Monday's edition of the Wall Street Journal on the trial of Geert Wilders. Now, I mentioned this in a previous edition of the briefing because this is a truly scary development. We have here an elected member of the Dutch parliament who is on trial for hate speech, for comments he has made, he's not denied, by the way, that are very critical of Islam. The kind of statements he makes are certainly graphic, suggesting that he should compare Islam to Nazism, the Quran to Mein Kampf. He has called for an end to Muslim immigration to the Netherlands. And by the way, there are now so many Muslims in the Netherlands that both political parties, all the major political parties, have to be concerned that the Muslim vote can actually turn an election. But Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who has herself been the victim of attempted violence by Muslims, suggests that the big issue is the question, how is it possible that a mature European liberal democracy is prosecuting an elected member of parliament for his political opinions on the most pressing issue of the day, namely Islamic fundamentalism? Now, one of the interesting things that she documents is the particular penal code that he has violated. The Dutch Penal Code, section article 137C, says that there is a sanction against anyone, quote, who publicly, verbally, or in writing or image deliberately expresses himself in any way insulting of a group of people because of their race, their religion, or belief. It goes on to say this person will be punished with a prison sentence of at the most 1 year, a fine of a third category. It continues that the offense is committed by a person who makes it his profession or habit, or by two or more people in association, a prison sentence at the most 2 years or a fine of fourth category will be imposed. Now, Ms. Ali is exactly right. This is a blasphemy trial. And it's a blasphemy trial that is absolutely haunting, as it is taking place as a way to chill speech, as a way of using the category of hate speech to end a dialogue about Islam. Folks, if this kind of thing doesn't scare you, you're not counting the cost of what it means for a free society to buy into the idea of hate speech and to sanction those who would seek to have a conversation about, well, Ms. Ali has it right, that which is simply unavoidable as a topic of conversation. Monday's edition of USA Today is really interesting. The front page story is USA's debate over government's role. The cover story is a breakdown based on a study reported in USA Today of how the electorate goes into different categories. The election looming before us, they break it down statistically. Susan Page, writing for USA Today, suggests that there are basically five different sectors of the American electorate. She suggests that we now have the reality of what she calls the Tea Party tendencies. These are those who basically sympathize with the Tea Party. She suggests, based upon this study, and it's a big study, that that represents 22% of the American electorate. That's pretty huge. As a matter of fact, only one group is larger. The second group she identifies are the religious right, distinct from the Tea Party tendencies of the first group, not because of economic issues, but because of moral issues. The religious right sees a much more important role for government in framing morality. In the middle, 17%. That's right. Only 17% are centrists who basically want a small government. But they also want some government involvement. Basically, this group comes down to wanting the government they like and not wanting the parts of government they don't like. But then moving to the left, the next group are Obama liberals, 24%. That's right. About one out of four, according to the study, of those in the American electorate are there basically very close to Barack Obama. They see themselves politically and worldviewishly very much in line with the incumbent president. But to the left is another 20%. They are called the bigger is better group in the study. They want a big government. They want the redistribution of wealth. They want a welfare state. They want social programs. They want more federal spending and not less. Now, you put all this together, and it's an interesting math. If you look at the right, it adds up to 39%. If you look at the left, it amounts to 44%, with 17% in the middle. Now, if this study is true, well, the election looming before us doesn't seem to make much sense. But as it turns out, and as you might guess, this kind of study is basically, well, very superficial. It asks the kinds of questions that break people down into categories, and if it's superficial, it is, we have to admit, also interesting. I especially appreciate the differentiation between the Tea Party tendencies and the religious right. But at the end of the day, voters vote on a number of issues and a number of candidates on the basis of a thought process that even they may not be able to very clearly articulate. Certainly, instinct and intuition goes into this, as does just the recognition that for some people, they hardly know how they're going to vote till they go into the voting booth. Hard as that is to believe, that's true for a frighteningly large percentage of our fellow citizens. Regardless of where people fall on this particular spectrum, the reality is they're likely at different points to be in different places. But if driven by conviction, they're going to be following a worldview grid that makes the issues make sense. Election in, election out. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/albertmohler. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. I want you to mark your calendar for October the 22nd. That's Boyce College Preview Day. It is the greatest opportunity for someone interested in Boyce College, someone looking at a college decision, or parents and others who are working with someone trying to make that decision, for you to come to Southern Seminary, to Boyce College, and learn more about the outstanding college experience, the wonderful faculty, and the quality experience of Boyce College. Now, we're happy for you to come anytime to visit the campus for either the seminary or the college, but a preview day, it affords the greatest opportunity for the most concentrated experience. Again, that's October 22nd. For more information, go to Boyce College, that's BOYCE College.com. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.